And sorry again that I missed the class on Friday, but we'll make that up at 2 o'clock today, right here. And sorry yet for the last time that I'll miss a class on Wednesday morning. This isn't normal for me to have so many conflicts. But we'll make up that on Thursday at 2. Okay. So we're talking about nitrogen vacancy defects in diamond, really because they're a small quantum system, incredibly coherent, easy to work with, and you can put it just about anywhere. And so the idea is that it's a small example of a quantum transducer that we can get out in the environment and actually use it for quantum devices. And I want to take and show you over the two lectures today the complete Hamiltonian and how we get control over that. And although it's a small system, there's a lot of complexity in the Hamiltonian because it's not obvious what we should choose for the eigenbasis. In most systems, you know, you have a strong energy axis, and you know you're going to quantize along that energy axis, and life is good. Here, the energy axis is going to change depending for the nuclear spins. It's going to change depending upon the state of the electron spins. And we're going to show you the complexity of that. And so I want to do it in three steps. First, I'm going to do it just for a real simple electron nuclear spin system, so even simpler than the NV. And then we'll go through it for the NV by writing down the secular part of the Hamiltonian and a non-secular piece. And so we'll effectively guess an eigenbasis. And anything that commutes with that we'll throw into the secular piece. And then we'll have what's left over, and it will be the non-secular. And then we'll use perturbation theory to explore what happens with the non-secular, with the idea that in perturbation theory, we'll come up with a simple answer. We'll be able to get some insight into the dynamics of the system. Now, of course, it won't be the full answer because it's perturbation theory. And in the lab, we go and we numerically calculate the eigenbasis. It's a small enough system, you can do that. And that's even necessary to get as high a fidelity control. But if you just go that way, then you get pages of algebra from Mathematica. It doesn't really mean anything to you. And so it's useful to take this additional step, even if at the end you're not going to use it, just so that you can build up some intuition about what you should be doing. Okay? So I'll show you that. But we're going to start with one electron and then some nuclear spins. And by one electron now, I'm talking about one electron, so it's a spin 1/2. Not like the NV system, right, where we have multiple electrons and we treat an effective electron as a spin 1. But right now, just for a few minutes, we'll go back and talk about that. And what we're looking for is how to achieve coherent control. And in achieving coherent control, I want two things. I want first it to be efficient, so fast. And then I'd like it to be precise, so I'd like it to be correct, free of errors. So let's see what we have. We have an electron spin. And the electron spin, since there's only one of them, is going to have a Zeeman interaction. And that's just an interaction with an applied magnetic field. Yeah.
By correcting the error rate is low.
Yes, that's right. So we have a Zeeman interaction, which is an interaction with an applied magnetic field. And I'm going to put the field along the z direction, just because I have to put it somewhere, so let's call whatever that direction is z. And then we have a number of nuclear spins. And the nuclear spins also have a Zeeman interaction, with a Hamiltonian that looks just like the other, except that the gyromagnetic ratio is a factor of 1,000 or so smaller. There's a hyperfine interaction between the electron and the nuclear spins. And there's dipole interactions between the nuclear spins. Dipole-dipole, I should write it out. Now, the dipole-dipole interaction is going to have a term that looks like looks like this, where I've kept only the secular parts of the dipole-dipole interaction, assuming for a second that this is the quantization axis. We'll see, we'll have to modify that a little bit. And so that's why it has this asymmetry here, why it looks like a cylindrically symmetric interaction. I won't say more about it because we're very quickly going to say we're not interested in it. Okay. The hyperfine interaction has two terms. There's one term which is a Fermi contact interaction that says I have a molecular orbital that is shared by this nuclear spin, and this electron appears in it. And so the electron, if that molecular orbital has S character at the nuclear spin, then of course the electron overlaps with the nucleus, right? The S orbitals are the only orbitals that don't have a node at the nucleus. And so by having an overlap, a direct overlap of the electron spin with the nucleus, then there's a spin-spin interaction between those. And so the Fermi contact term has a Hamiltonian that goes as sigma dot sigma, electron nuclear. The second type of hyperfine interaction. And so it has an amplitude, which I should write out in terms of the molecular wave function and its overlap with the S orbital. But I'm not going to do that, just because it gets to be a mess. And at the end, there's nothing we're going to do with it anyways, right? So there's a frequency there. And then there's a dipole term, which is exactly like this dipole term. It says that I have two spin one-half magnets, two spins one-half, they act like bar magnets, and so there's an energy between them. And of course, the energy falls off with distance, That's the strength of the magnetic moments. There's an angular dependence depending upon how I move those magnets. And of course, the Pauli operators. And so we'll have here a Hamiltonian that goes as sigma electron dot sigma nucleus minus sigma z electron, sigma z nucleus. Again, assuming that we keep z as the quantum number. Now I want to rewrite that quickly. So it was your chance. I'll rewrite it as this. Sigma electron, a hyperfine sigma nucleus, so that we have a tensor interaction. And so that's a more complete description of it. It allows everything to happen. We don't have to have specify quantization. I need to add one more piece here. So this is our small quantum processor. And of course, I can have another electron spin sitting down here. With all the same nuclear types. And there's an interaction between here. And again, comes in two flavors. It comes in an exchange interaction. That again looks like sigma dot sigma, both of the electron spins. And there's a dipole interaction that goes as sigma electron d sigma electron. Sigma electron. Okay. So we come back to our control. The first thing is I want it to be fast. And if I come through and say, how strong are things? Well, the electron-Zeeman interaction, typically in systems, is some gigahertz. 2 to 10 to 20 gigahertz. So this is fast. The dipole-dipole interaction depends upon the distance between the two electrons. But that typically is fast as well, megahertz. The hyperfine interaction is hundreds of megahertz. Could be tens to hundreds of megahertz, let's say. The nuclear spins, well, the Zeeman interaction is not so bad. It's tens of megahertz. The dipole-dipole interaction, well, nuclear spins, their dipole moments are really small, right? And so if we said, oh, we can get to megahertz over here, but each of these is a factor of 1,000 smaller than the corresponding frequency over here, this is going to be really small. So this is going to be of order kilohertz. So this becomes effectively too small to use. So we'd like to throw it away. Now, when I have coherent control, of course, I want it to be efficient. So it has to be universal. I have to be able to go everywhere in Hilbert space. And so if I want to have universal control, let's break this down for a start, for one electron, one nuclear spin. We'll come back to this picture, but for a moment, we'll take one electron, one nuclear spin. And I'm going to abstract from this and just keep the parts of the Hamiltonian I like. So I'll keep the Zeeman term for the electron spin. So we said that was fast. I'll keep the hyperfine, well, I'll keep the Zeeman term for the nuclear spin. And I'll keep the hyperfine interaction between them. I'm going to write the hyperfine interaction in terms of two pieces. Over here. Now let me explain to you why I wrote it that way. The electron spin is quantized in the applied magnetic field, in the Zeeman term. This is the biggest interaction, right? This is the biggest thing we have. Therefore, the magnetic moments of the electron spin along the z-axis, these are good quantum numbers. So we can take ms equal plus or minus 1/2 as good quantum numbers. What that means is that the energy will be proportional to them, right? So or we can say that these will be the eigenbasis of that interaction. All of that is the same. This term is going to be for usually something like 15 megahertz. This will be about 30 megahertz. This will be about 60 megahertz. And the reason I've only kept the Z component of the electron spin is we said, hey, we know what the good quantum number is. And so if I come back to the hyperfine and I look at this, it might be tempting to say, oh, I should keep, you know, sigma x, and sigma y, or down here, I should keep sigma x, sigma y, or any other combination. But anything that's not sigma z is going to be non-secular. And because this is small relative to this term, let's just take this to be our 10 gigahertz. That's a pretty common piece. So it's, you know, small. So one part in 1,000. I don't want to keep the non-secular pieces of the electron spin. And we'll say, well, why choose this one, right? I could have chosen y here, right? I mean, there's, but because I have a sigma z term, I'm free to choose any basis I like for the x and y coordinate system. So I'll just choose one and I'll call it x. I'll say, ah, that's no problem. Wherever the frequency is maximum, we'll call that the x-axis in the nuclear spin, right? The electron spin, we've defined the quantization axis. And all I know here is that this piece, it should be cylindrically symmetric. And so I've defined it that way. All right. Now, we're not done yet. So this is the minimum complexity, one electron, one nuclear spin. I want to remind you of these eigenpotents, right, that they can define E plus and minus as projectors. And so the identity is simply the sum of these, and sigma z is the difference in these. So now we have a four-level system, one electron, one nuclear spin. So this is the energy axis. And we'll say, ah, these states are the electron spin up and these states are the electron spin down. We don't know anything else yet, right? The only thing we've said is a good quantum number is the electron spin. Now I'm going to rewrite the Hamiltonian. I want to rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of these eigenpotents on the electron spin because I want to find what the good quantum numbers are for the nuclear spin. And so now I say, well, I have a Hamiltonian that I'm interested in for the nuclear spin. It, of course, depends upon the electron spin. But I'm going to drop that first term. There's nothing interesting there for the nuclear spin. So this thing is going to look like omega n over 2 e plus. plus E minus sigma Z. We can drop the label for the nuclear spins now. There'll be a term that is omega A over 2 E plus minus E minus sigma Z, and omega B over 2 E plus minus E minus sigma X. And so now it becomes very easy. We say, oh yes, what happens here is that we have a nuclear Hamiltonian that looks like that looks like this if the electron spin is up. It looks like that if the electron spin is down. Right? And so depending upon which of these manifolds I'm in, there's a different eigenbasis for the nuclear spin. So we'll label them. It is easy enough to calculate it all exactly, okay? But we don't need to do that. All we need to do is label them. And so now we have an eigenbasis here. Of course, alpha and alpha perp are orthonormal, as beta and beta perp are orthonormal, but alpha beta is not equal to zero, and alpha beta perp is not equal to zero, right? And so the system has one basis here and another basis there. Yeah. Now that sounds pretty good. It almost gives you universal control because the nuclear spin lives in SU2, so it lives on a Bloch sphere. And now I'm telling you, oh, well, if the electron spin is up, there's some quantization axis for the nuclear spin, right? It sees this effective Hamiltonian. And so it's going to rotate about that effective direction. And if the electron spin is down, it's going to rotate about some other direction. And you'll be able to convince yourself that if you have a Bloch sphere and you have two different axes that you can rotate about, as long as they're not 180 degrees apart from each other, or you know, they don't completely overlap, then you have universal control. You can take one state and transform to any other state on the Bloch sphere simply by rotating between those two. Okay? So now then we have almost universal control. We don't quite, because, of course, we haven't given ourselves any way of rotating the electron spin. So if we want the universal control over the nuclear spin, we need to add one more interaction. It's not on the nuclear spin. We need to add an interaction to the electron spin. So we come here and we add a control field. So we add a Rabi drive to the electron spin. And now, by this being under our experimental control, I can change the state of the electron spin, in which case I can move myself between these two manifolds, and I have universal control over the nuclear spin system. Okay. Now, Let's think about how we can tell that we have universal control. The one way I said, oh, we can map this onto a block sphere, and you can see that by rotating about two axes, you can get everywhere. And of course, it's easy to talk about block spheres. And then someone's going to give you another qubit, and now you have SU4, and we have no simple pictures, right? So we want something a little bit more useful than having to go back to block spheres. Now, one way of doing it is to say, hey, I know that these terms are non-zero. And in fact, it's easy to show that these terms, the sigma x operation, are non-zero. And so every transition here is allowed. Every transition is a dipole allowed transition. And so one way of getting universality is if there is a path, doesn't matter how convoluted, that will take you from one eigenstate to any other eigenstate via an allowed transition, you have universal control. Okay? So that we can do. And you don't need to have something as well connected as this, right? If I didn't have all those, and I had only these three outer transitions, we would have universal control. The nicer way of doing it is to say, do we have a Lie algebra? So we have the terms in the Hamiltonian. And we could ask the question of, if I take the terms sigma z electron, sigma z electron, sigma z nucleus, sigma z electron, sigma x, if I take those terms that are in the Hamiltonian, and I take all the commutators of them, okay, and I keep taking all the commutators of the commutators of the commutators, would I generate a complete algebra? And of course, a complete algebra is we're in SU4, so there's 16 operators over SU4. And you can immediately see that it isn't going to work, right? Because I only have Z operators on the electron spin. But if I add to this the control operator on the electron spin, now then it's easy to show that by looking at nested commutators, you can create every operator of that space. Okay, so that's the nicest formalist way. Now if I just take it like this, there's a small challenge that of course, these terms don't come independently in the Hamiltonian, they come with some particular weighting. And there might be some symmetry in the amplitudes of the coefficients that would prevent me from going everywhere. So what I really should do is to take the two Hamiltonians that we have control over, that full Hamiltonian in sigma x, and look at the commutators of all of those. But since I've chosen those frequencies at random, this will give us the same answer in this particular case. Okay, so now then, we have a system that gives us universal control of electron nuclear spin systems, and we don't have to use very much of all of these terms here, right? We had to use the electron Zeeman term, we had to use the control interaction, we had to use a piece of the hyperfine term, and we used the Zeeman term. And the rest of these things we just threw away as being either too small or not necessary. They add. What do I mean by not necessary? I mean, here we're asking, how do we get control? Do we have control? Right? And so I want to make sure they have big terms that I can control. Here it says, hey, do I have the correct control? When I talk about the correct control, I better be careful not to throw away a term in the Hamiltonian. But when I'm asking, how am I going to generate control? Then all I care about are the biggest terms to say, do I have a means of getting control over the system? Yeah? Okay. So now what I want to do is to take the same model and apply it to the NB system and to look at the dynamics there. So in the NV system, we start off by saying, again, we have an electron and a nuclear spin, or a variety of nuclear spins. Now, the electron spin is this virtual electron spin. And so the Hamiltonian has this term that is a zero field splitting. Of this spin one electron. There remains a Zeeman term and of course this has exactly the same dependence as we had before. And we're going to keep a hyperfine term. And let me just write it out as a tensor for a second. Start over here. So in this particular case, much like the one up above, we have a dominant term that's going to lead to knowing what the quantization axis is of the electron spin. So the electron spin quantization axis is given by the zero field splitting, which turns out to be 3 gigahertz in that system. And we showed you that we could create the zero field splitting by taking two electron spins and having an exchange couple, right? We showed that if we had two spin 1/2 particles and we turned on an exchange coupling, we got a zero field splitting. Okay. So now then we have the MS equals zero and the MS equals plus and minus one manifold, and the energy separation here is delta. And of course, those are degenerate. Then we add the Zeeman field. And the Zeeman field I'm going to add in two terms. The first piece we're going to add is secular. So now we add the secular Zeeman field, which is gamma BZ sigma SC with the electron. And so this separation now is twice the Zeeman term. And of course, that separation remains delta, and now we've split the energies, so this is plus one, and that's minus one eigenstate. Now, the challenge here is that the zero field splitting, remember, it's a tensor as well when we calculate the exchange interaction. And there's a principal axis system for it. It's a cylindrically symmetric piece. And the principal axis system is aligned with the nitrogen vacancy axis. So we know that direction. But it's very, very, very hard to align the external field exactly with it. And so it's always going to be some non-secular piece. And you would think that the non-secular piece, so there's one, let's draw this. We have the nitrogen, we have the vacancy, there's an axis here. And somewhere we have a field that we apply. This is under our control, and there's some angle about it. And we say that direction is Z. Okay. And there's only one angle, right? Because there's only one vector here. So regardless, there's only one angle. And so I can say, oh, well, I'll take and I'll call X that axis that's in the plane of those two vectors. Okay? So the non-secular piece, this is going to be gamma E B along the x-axis, SC. And it's really tempting just to say, oh, no, that's very small. But it's going to, yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. So we're saying that this is defining the energy axis because it's the biggest term. And this piece will commute with that because this comes in as SC squared. So this piece is going to shift the energies, right? But it won't change the eigenstructure. And when I add this piece, which would help if I wrote it correctly, when I add this piece, okay, now it no longer commutes there. So it's going to do something complicated. Since this is small compared to those, it's not going to shift the energies very much. But it's going to allow a mixing of energy levels. And even then, it's not going to change the electron spin dynamics very much. But we've got the nuclear spin dynamics up there. It'll have a really big effect on the nuclear spins. You also saw when you calculated this adiabatic transition between an anticrossing. What'll happen is when we add this term, we'll create a bunch of more anticrossings in the system. So this will make the whole dynamics much richer. And even though it's small, it's going to have a huge effect. We'll see how that goes. Okay. So what we're going to do is we'll keep the eigenbasis of the electron spin. And we'll assume that there's an eigenbasis, well, there better be, of the nuclear spin. And this one we don't know. Okay? But we're going to assume it has that nice little form to it. And can I just save myself a piece here? I can. Okay, so there's that, there's that. Okay, so we'll look at the secular piece like this. We keep the zero field splitting. We keep the Z component to the Zeeman term. The nuclear spin, the Zeeman term of the nuclear spin doesn't depend on the electron spin. So certainly that's secular. We don't know the basis, right? But it's secular. And here we keep the Z basis of the hyperfine interaction. Okay, we haven't defined the nuclear basis. Okay, so this is the nuclear Zeeman. And this is the hyperfine. Okay. And now then we write out the non-secular. And so there's going to be a term which is gamma. I'm going to write it down as I did in my notes here, instead of like that, just so that I don't make too many errors. I'll still make a few. We have all of those off-diagonal states. Now, if we look at perturbation theory, now, remember that I don't care. The energy of the system is given by the electron spin. The nuclear spin is never going to add any term that gives any interesting energies. So we just keep the energy basis of the electron spin. It's the only piece I care about. Now, if I look at perturbation theory, then in the first order perturbation theory, we expect to be looking at terms like this. And they're all going to be zero, right? Because there's no term in this Hamiltonian, this non-secular Hamiltonian, which is going to leave an eigenbasis of the electron spin alone. Right? Remember that Sx is equal to S plus S minus over 2, and Sy is equal to S plus minus over 2i. Right? And so we're always going to be raising or lowering one of the eigenbases. And so in the first order, all the first order corrections go to zero. And so the only thing we have to worry about is the second order in perturbation theory. And the second order in perturbation theory is going to have terms that look like that looks like this. This is second order. And so these, of course, will be non-zero when N and M are not the same. Okay? So we're just going to look at those perturbation terms. And as I do this, again, I'm going to just keep the piece of the electron spin. The nuclear spin, we don't really care about. Now, where are we going to see? We're going to see terms that are, they'll be, if I look in second order, there'll be four of these terms. There'll be terms that look like the Zeeman-Zeeman interaction. Right, that can take the non-secular Zeeman here, the non-secular Zeeman there, and I'll have a Zeeman-Zeeman term. Of course, you know, you could say, hey, there's one term. I take this whole thing and I put it in there and I expand it out twice. But when I do that, I can factor it, right? So there'll be Zeeman-Zeeman terms. There'll be a Zeeman hyperfine term, okay? And then there'll be two hyperfine terms, hyperfine, hyperfine terms. There'll be a hyperfine, hyperfine term where the two nuclear spins in the hyperfine interaction are the same, and it'll be a hyperfine, hyperfine term where the two spins are different. Okay. So we have lots of terms to look at. But today, this morning, we'll just look at the Zeeman, Zeeman. Okay. So the energy shift second order for the Zeeman-Zeeman term. And it's useful to write these out separately for all the n. So let's just take this for n is equal to 1. And I'll give you, in this case, the coefficients, but it doesn't matter. It'll never fit. Okay, for n equals 1, there'll only be this term. Now, of course, you'll tell me that I should include the minus 1 state here too, right? For n equals 1, I'm saying I'm looking at the inner product here for the ms equals 1 state. With the ms equals 0 state, there are, of course, transitions. If I put here the minus 1 state, there'd be no transitions that would lead to plus 1, right? Because then I would have to have a term that looks like sx squared. Okay, so yes, there is another term for minus 1, but that term is strictly 0. So we'll just keep the one that we care about, right? That's non-zero. And now then, we go and use these relationships to rewrite this. And if we do that, we'll find that we have a term that looks like s plus s minus over 2 bx plus s plus minus s minus over 2i by 0. And okay, we have the Hermitian conjugate over there. Here, you see that what happens is that Only the S plus terms contribute. Over here, of course, only S minus contributes, right? And so if we keep S plus, then we say, okay, we get rid of that one, get rid of that one. We have these nice pieces. And so we end up having a system that looks like etc. And now we end up all together having bx minus 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 I by. So the inner product is equal to that vector of the field. Yeah? So there's a factor of a half in front of the whole thing. Here. There's a factor of a square root of 2 from both. Yeah? Absolutely. I was just trying to forget those things, but I shouldn't. And over here, we have bx plus iby, right? And so we end up having a term that is bx squared plus by squared for the whole proportionality. And so at the end of the day, this contribution comes in as 1/2 gamma squared over delta squared bx squared plus by squared. And this, of course, is the n equals 1 piece of that. And I'm sure you know all this stuff, but let me remind you that this is the inner product that this depends upon. If I'm looking at the shift in energy, I have to divide by the energy difference between those states. And the energy difference between those states is delta plus this small shift. But this small shift is so small, I'm going to throw it away, just to give us a little bit of insight without having to keep that around. So that's where the delta came from. Yeah? Okay. We do likewise the same thing for the others that I'll do later on. And what we find is that when we look at the non-secular Zeeman piece, this gets shifted down, and these both get shifted up in the same direction. And so we end up, and we'll calculate that. It is roughly proportional to this. There's a factor of 3, which you'll see where it comes from. So we see that we end up having these energy levels that are shifted a little bit, but they're shifted in exactly the same way. Okay? Now, you're going to tell me that so far, that doesn't look like the most exciting of effects. I'm telling you, there's a small energy shift, and this afternoon we'll calculate how big it is. The reason we go through this is to give you a simple framework so that when I go through the hyperfine piece, we see that we'll pick up a term that depends upon the nuclear spins. And so if I look at the energy level diagram and I added the nuclear spins here, who would say, ah, there should be no hyperfine interaction of the nuclear spins in the Zeeman in the MS equals zero state, right? Because if I take SZ equals zero, the secular contribution from this term is, of course, zero. But in fact, we'll add that term back in. And even a small term compared to zero looks big. And so we'll find that in fact, there's what will appear to be a Zeeman interaction of the nuclear spins in the MS equals zero manifold, which actually arises through the hyperfine interaction. Okay? So we'll stop here. We'll continue with this, and we'll continue drawing out this picture at 2. And we'll show that although the Zeeman piece gives us a really simplistic picture of the dynamics, the Zeeman hyperfine pieces will give us a more interesting piece in our control. And it will allow us to have control in this manifold, which normally we would think is impossible. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot to pay attention to here. And